Thanks again to Sentry.io for sponsoring Does Not Compute. Sentry knows that developers' code is broken, and they just want to help everyone fix it. They know that you can sometimes test your code, but you're always going to miss edge cases. And you could rely on error reports from your users to fix things, but that's a bad experience for the users. You're going to get incomplete information and be unable to reproduce the errors. Instead, you should rely on Sentry. You plug it right into your application and get detailed information about every crash in your application. Things like a stack trace, the git commit where that code was checked in, the developer who checked it in, the release of your application, and even the user who caused the error. You'll get a breadcrumb trail that tells you everything that happened leading up to the error, including things like on JavaScript, you get a console log, URL navigation, AJAX requests, all that stuff, everything you need to recreate the problem locally. It integrates with your deployment pipeline too, so some errors won't even make it to production. They have first-party library support for many client and server platforms, including Vue.js, Rails, and Elixir, a couple of DNC favorites. So head on over to Sentry.io to give it a try. There's a free developer account, no credit card required, and it's perfect for personal projects and early-stage applications. Sentry.io. Your code is broken. Let's fix it together.
I've been having problems with Electron-related calls all day. So we have a stand-up call on Wednesdays, and I couldn't hear a thing anyone was saying. And so I just posted in general, sorry, I can't hear anybody. I've restarted my computer. I restarted all the apps. I don't know what else to do. And the crazy thing is the only thing that's changed in my setup is my monitor.
You're not going through the monitor with like a hub or anything, right?
Well, no. So, okay. So there's two things that changed. Let's just debug this now. There's two things that changed. I got rid of my ultra wide monitor and I got a smaller 27-inch 4K monitor. And so it turns out that the USB-C hub that I have, even though it says, hey, the HDMI port supports 4K streaming, there's a giant asterisk next to it that says at 30 hertz, not 60. So I plug it in. I'm like, wow, this looks terrible. So after a bunch of research, it seems like USB-C hubs that actually do work well for 60 hertz 4K video or monitor support, they're all like north of $300, $200, $300. So the consensus was I had to go to Best Buy and look on the back of all of the different adapters, and it had to be a USB to something specific. So I got two things. I got a USB-C to DisplayPort cord, and I got a USB-C to HDMI adapter. And that works. But because I am now no longer using my USB-C dock that I had, all four ports are used up with different USB-C things. So I have my USB switcher, which switches my USB inputs between my keyboard and mouse between my PC and my Mac. I have, and my audio interface too. So maybe that's it. I don't know. Anyway, yeah. So like if you get a 4K monitor, make sure that you either have a really fancy USB-C dock or an actual USB-C to HDMI 2 cord. But yeah, that's the only thing that's changed.
I don't know how normal people can figure out. Like you're just boring me just describing USB-C problems. And like, I don't understand how
yeah, sorry.
No, it's just, I don't understand how like the USB spec became something that was like so good and like literally universal. It's in the name and just became this like monstrosity of, you know, there's good thing about specifications is there's so many to choose from. USB-C just, man, I don't know. I keep waiting for the day when it all kind of comes together, but today is not that day. There's so many different levels of support. It's really confusing for the end user.
Yeah, so I just basically rolled up all of my cords in a little braid, and now I just put my laptop and plug three cords in instead of one, but still, it works fine, and the display looks great, and I have way more desk space now for activities and thinking, so I'm happy with it.
That's cool. Well, yeah, this Zoom US thing seems to work pretty well. It's based off WebRTC, which I know and love, and generally works pretty well. So, two thumbs up for that.
Yeah, I wonder what the main difference is there, because I had a video call this morning, and it worked great. And then I had two Slack calls today, and they were trash. And then we called each other not that long ago, and it was trash.
And those are both Electron-based apps, but they both also use WebRTC, as far as I know. So, I don't know.
Right.
I don't know.
So back before I had a USB-C MacBook Pro, I think originally when we started doing the show with Paul, I had a FireWire interface, and it was a mess with anything Electron-based.
Oh, man, FireWire.
It would actually, I think my audio would clip every like half second, and my voice would cut out just repeatedly. And I think we had to do all that. We had to do all of our calls over Skype because that was the only thing that would work.
Weird.
Messed up. Yeah. What have you been up to?
Oh, man. Not a ton of work, but this past weekend, I went to the quote-unquote mecca of ham radio for our yearly trip to Dayton, Ohio. Let me tell you, there's not a lot going on in Dayton, Ohio, but every year there's the Hamvention, which brings in tens of thousands of hams from all over the globe for a big conference and gigantic.
Why Dayton?
Historically, that's just where it's been. You know, there's ham fests all over the place. Clubs will host them, and people will come, and there's smaller ones. And this one was hosted by Dayton Amateur Radio Association, and it just happened to grow over the years and become like the main event. There's no particular reason other than that's where it is.
That's cool. So you said how many people? Tens of thousands?
Yeah, probably. I think last year it was 30,000.
Wow.
And it seemed a lot even busier. It seemed a lot busier this year even. So I would guess more than that. But it's a big show. It's where all the big companies announce all their products. It's a good chance for us to, you know, we don't have a booth there, but it's a good chance for us to network and meet with people and pick their brains and talk about what's new and just get ideas and kind of, I always come back sort of reinvigorated with my interest in the hobby. Like, I'm so disconnected from, you know, the actual hobby of ham radio itself because I'm just programming all day. And to meet with people who, you know, use my product, like all our customers are there, you know, I get to see them and get feedback from them, which is always really nice. And just guys I've known for years, and sometimes people you've only even met on the air, right? You get to meet them for the first time. You only know their call signs. You don't even know their real first names. It's a lot of fun and exhausting. And it was like, it's the first real summer day on Saturday there, walking around the flea market, and it was hot, but it was a really good time. And like I said, just kind of reinvigorating my interest in working on the product and working on new things and just kind of getting back into the swing of things. So yeah, it was really good. There were not really any big announcements that directly affected us, although there was one really interesting one. We heard about this. We had no idea this was coming. The day before we flew out there. And this company called MFJ, which makes like everything under the sun for ham radio hobbyists, came out with a product called the Rig Pi, RIGPI. And it's literally a metal box. It's about the size of, maybe two decks of cards stacked on top of each other. And inside, it's a Raspberry Pi. And then like one or two interface boards stacked on top of it with like audio devices and serial devices and a bunch of ham radio related crap. And what this thing does is you put it in your shack, you plug all your crap into it, and you can remotely control your station. Sound familiar, right?
Yeah.
And we've been talking about years for doing this business model for ourselves is basically licensing our actual station control software to other people. Basically make our own box that is like beautiful. People can just set it up and plug it in and configure it via the cloud and access their station via the cloud and everything. And, you know, it's, we just never have gone down that route because supporting hardware and supporting everybody's unique configurations, just, it's not a business we want to be in really. But this RigPi thing came out. And so we're like, okay, that's cool. And it claims to be all these different things. And so I go over to the booth to meet the guy. And it turns out this guy, Howard, who I knew from back when I lived in Santa Rosa, like 5 years ago, developed it. Which was cool.
That's crazy.
And so I was, you know, picking his brain and asking him about how he's implementing stuff. And so I was like, okay, so how are you doing the, you know, it does all the station control pieces, you control your radio, your rotors, blah, blah, blah. It's great. I'm like, okay, well, how do you do the audio? He's like, oh, we use Mumble, which I'd never even heard of Mumble before. I guess it's a like TeamSpeak, I guess.
Oh, you know what? That does sound familiar, actually. I have seen this. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's just an open source VoIP thing. So he's like, oh yeah, we use Mumble, so you have to download this other app just to do the voice. I'm like, okay. And then I'm like, well, how do you do digital modes, because digital modes are this thing where like you need special software, you need virtual audio devices and computer control and stuff. He's like, oh, you just VNC into the box and use the software on the little Raspberry Pi. And I'm like, okay, so you haven't really done anything unique. Like, this is not a threat to us right. at all. You know, it's just a totally different platform.
Yeah.
And it's not how I would do it, of course. And but what the takeaway was that like it's going to he sold out of the boxes. I met him like halfway through the first day at like noon. He had already sold out of all of them, right? Because guys want these.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like a $300 box. And this is only good for us because it's going to expose guys to remote operations, which is what we're good at. And if they have a less than optimal experience, then you know, that's only better for us, right? It sounds really nefarious. Like we don't want it to fail, obviously, but we want people to be operating and to be exposed to their, you know, unique remote operating experience. So I don't know. It's only a net win for us. I don't really feel threatened by it at all.
Yeah, I get that feeling a little bit too, because a lot of people, when I mention what DK does, they're like, oh, can't you do that with Shopify plus A, B, and C, right? Yeah, you can. But a lot of our customers don't want to do that. They don't have time to do it. They don't have the interest to do it, the energy to do it, the expertise to do it. And that's fine. It's just a different flavor, I suppose, right? And that's where we kind of make our living, is off of a better experience for them. You know, they want to show up and they want to know what they get out of it. And then if they like that, they stay. You know, they're not interested in putting in the work and downloading this other thing over here and configuring this thing here. They just want it to work, right? So that's cool. I don't know. It's cool to experience stuff like that, like seeing something that's kind of tangential to what you're doing and seeing how they do it, and then coming out the other side feeling good about where you're at and what you're offering. That's cool.
Yeah, when you see the first announcement and all the things is promising, and then you actually dig into the nitty gritty and understand it's just something different than what you thought. You know, it's fine.
So I'm looking at this MFJ website, and this is wild. It reminds me of Ling's Cars, I think it was called. Have you ever seen Ling's Cars?
No.
Oh man, this is great. So if anyone's interested, I push it in the show notes.
Oh my god!
I guess you've seen it.
No, I'm looking at it now. What in the world? Good god!
I don't know. I used to look at this every now and then, back in the day. How can I describe this? It's like the Angel Fire sites of old that were full of animated GIFs and tacky things, and things are flashing. It's like the New York Strip of websites, if it were made in the early 2000s, maybe. I don't know how else to describe it. The MFJ site is similar. There's less moving things, but it's very like plain, just table based layout. Nothing wrong with that. It's just I haven't seen anything like this in a while.
This is par for the course for any ham radio related site.
It's also interesting that the link to the press release or the sales page for the MIGPI is a PDF.
I mean, don't get me wrong. It is a cool little box. Again, it's just not how I would have implemented it.
Yeah, yeah.
I assume Howard's not listening. No hard feelings to Howard. He's a good guy.
Yeah, people want different stuff. Some people want to tinker, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that is kind of the beauty of it. You really nailed it. There's all levels of interaction, right? You can. Some people have been cobbling together solutions for this for years. You know, it's nothing new. Back in the day, people remoted stations using RF to RF links. Like you would use your handheld radio as, you know, the little walkie-talkie, which is like VHF. It's very short range, and they'd use that to control like the bigger radio, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. All kinds of stuff like that. So, yeah, MFJ is their business model is buy up something or have contract someone to make a design, and then cheapen it as much as possible and sell it. And they're gigantic. I mean, they make everything. So, also known as Mighty Fine Junk in the community.
Is that what people call it?
Yeah.
It's funny.
So, yeah, Hamvention was a rousing success, and it was fun. And that's pretty much it. I'm just trying to distill everything down that I learned and move forward with a newly new invigorated desire to work on things. So that's pretty much it for me.
Yeah, I'm glad that you're able to kind of go away and get refreshed and feel invigorated and recharged and excited about what you're doing. That's always good. For me, I haven't actually gone to like a furniture convention yet because it's not necessarily something that I'm interested in. But I probably will before too long, just to kind of meet some of the customers and the clients and stuff like that. But
that would be an amazing learning experience, just to see what that's like, you know, and see how things are done currently.
Yeah, so Lindsay's described it really well because she also is a consumer. She has a store on Design Collective, so she is actually also a customer. So I guess we have the benefit of like having our owner be the target audience, and her family, because her family owns other furniture stores and stuff, be the actual target audience for what we're doing. So she's described it pretty well. But yeah, it's really interesting. Again, just like from what I understand, the original MVP target was like what they wanted it to do versus what we do now is completely different. Some of the features that they thought were going to be home runs, people don't even use. They just kind of sit around. And a lot of it has become just a whole core of our business, or a whole level of our business has become just account reps for stores, like saying, hey, we if you need something done, let us know, we can do it for you. And that's really one of the best things I think we can offer these people, because it turns out a lot of these people also run more than one business, just like my boss. You know, they have a storefront, but they're also manufacturing, you know, so they're talking with distributors, they're buying from manufacturers, they're talking about custom pieces, so they have all these moving parts in their life already. And for the most part, adding technology into it is just adding another moving part. But if they have a phone number they can call and someone picks up the phone and says, yeah, I can do that for you, you know, they're happy to pay as much as they have to for that. And that was something I like, because I came in and here I am a programmer, like we can automate it. The machines will do it for us. We don't even need people, you know. And then, you know, fast forward 2 years later, I'm like, no, we need people, because these people, they don't trust the machines, or they don't understand the machines, or they're not going to use the machines that we give them. So A, that means that we have a lot of design work to do, or B, that just means that the bread and butter of our target audience right now is not interested in software. They're interested in calling up a person and having something done.
There was some company, I can't remember off the top of my head what company it was. I'm not finding it right now, but they always advertised that they had a no hold, no wait policy. Like, you call on the phone and someone picks up, right? That's mm-hmm. absolutely appealing for those types of people. And that's super important. We always make sure we stay on top of our chat and support tickets and all that stuff and phone calls. We have a real phone number. We put in all our ads, right?
Yeah. One of the things people like the most is our Google Voice. I think it's called Google Voice, the services. They love to call our Google Voice number. And so that thing's ringing off the hook all the time. But yeah, so it's just been interesting, like how things have changed. Like my focus is, if that means that our people are doing some more of the work, that means that a lot of the software it's actually targeted for our team internally, as opposed to external customers. And I mean, we still target both, but it was just never a thought in our mind that we'd be writing software for an internal team to help them accomplish tasks for our actual customers faster. So it's like we have a SaaS, but we also have like an internal technology team writing tools for the company itself, which is kind of neat. But yeah, I think it could be good. I've met a few of our customers and clients in the past, like when I travel out to Southern California, and I walk down a certain street, I just see like, oh, that store's on our platform, you know. Sometimes I'll pop in and be like, hey, how's it going? I work on Design Collective. And they usually have all lots to say. But also it was interesting, last summer, Jamie and I were in San Clemente because she had an internship, and I was training at a gym there that was maybe 2 miles away from where we were staying. And I would walk down the street and I'm like, oh, that store's on our platform. You know, so pop in and say hi. It is interesting, like getting feedback from them directly versus getting feedback from them through the grapevine or from an email, because it feels different. It feels peer is not the right word. It's just, for the lack of a better saying, like straight from the horse's mouth. I don't know how else to say it, right? It's just different.
Yeah.
There's not like this layer that gets lost in translation.
Yeah, I think people are a lot more open, especially when you're having a conversation, like they're going to think of things that maybe like they wouldn't have thought of. You kind of lead them in a certain direction, or, you know, maybe they wouldn't, you know, they'd carefully compose an email or a support ticket or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, once you're just having a conversation, just talking face to face, it's totally, the story totally changes. And it's really, it is, it's definitely very valuable.
But yeah, apart from that stuff, what have I been up to? Just actually, it was interesting. Today, I spent most of the morning writing in a Google Doc, and I was using my iPad, which is something that felt very strange to me, because for me, for a very long time, work has felt like opening a text editor and typing into that, right? And here I'm sitting outside, I'm typing on my laptop. I'm like, well, my laptop's getting real hot because I'm sitting in the sun. All I'm doing is typing in Google Docs. I can just pull my iPad out and work on that. And I don't know why it felt so weird to me, but it felt like something just shifted in my mind. And I was like, oh, I am getting paid right now to not use an actual, I mean, an iPad is an actual computer, right? But it was different. It was different. Okay.
What's a computer?
It was the first time that realization has kind of happened to me. So we talked a while back about CTOs, like, when is it time to stop writing code? And obviously I'm not to that point yet. But I've been writing a lot more and thinking a lot more and not writing, like jumping into an editor and stuff. And also, maybe what makes it even weirder is the stuff I've been writing and thinking about isn't necessarily related to code specifically or a feature specifically. It's been around process, and I've been around workflows and stuff. So yeah, I've just been thinking a lot about that. I was talking to a friend of the show, Greg, the other day, and sorry, Greg, if you hear this, I've been meaning to work on an Insomnia feature. And I get a plus one in my email inbox every day, and it makes me not want to do it out of spite. But the feature that I'm supposed to be working on, or I said that I would work on, is a GraphQL documentation viewer for Insomnia. And so people are just like plus one-ing this thing every day. But he said, hey, you know, I'd be happy to pair on it sometime if you want. And he said, we can do some extreme programming stuff. And I was like, extreme programming? I've never heard of that.
Extreme!
Yeah, that was my first thought. I was like, what kind of term is that, extreme programming? And today I just looked it up because I was thinking, you know, Paul's transitioning out. It's a good time to kind of take stock of the current process that we have, what we're looking at, what we've been doing. Is there places that we can improve? Are there places, you know, that are causing stress or anxiety or just, you know, suboptimal? And yeah, so I typed in extreme programming into Google and landed on Wikipedia. And I started looking at this thing and I was like, oh, a lot of this stuff I try to already do. And so it's kind of one of those things where you're kind of putting a collection of practices together, but you don't have a term for it yet. So for music, for a long time, I was learning all these different bits of theory. And when I went to take a lesson with this new guy I had met, he kind of like asked me where I was at. And I said, okay, this is what I'm working on. This is what I'm learning. And he just put that issue in there. And he was like, oh, well, this stuff you're doing right here, the stuff that you're putting together, it's just called the Cage System. And it rocked my world because, like, oh, there's a name for this? And as soon as I started Googling the name, I was like, oh, it's all here. It's all right here. Everything I wanted to know is right here. And so it was kind of a similar thing. I was like, oh, extreme programming. So basically, extreme programming is, it's just like a collection of I guess it's like tangential to agile, but it's like a collection of processes, like things that should be done a certain way, and they're all geared towards productivity, and a lot of it's geared towards actually, like, you know, just quality and making sure that the programmer doesn't burn out. And so it's really heavy on things like pair programming, and I think extreme programming actually says up front, like, there shouldn't be any code committed that hasn't been pair programmed. Which is a bit, I don't know, it wouldn't be doable for Design Collective. But yeah, there's a lot of principles in here that I really like. And so most of today, and actually some of yesterday too, I've just been kind of putting together a Google Doc, like picking and choosing what I think would work really well for us. And I think what would help us kind of take things to the next level on the development side.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting here. The Wikipedia page calls out the name of extreme programming, because I always thought, like, the name sounds really kind of cheesy and like buzzwordy, right? But the methodology takes its name from the idea that the beneficial elements of traditional software engineering practices are taken to extreme levels. So that's where it comes from. It's like take one idea and take it to its logical extreme, for lack of a better word. you know, it's kind of an all or nothing approach. And
yeah.
I don't know. Like you said, you're just picking and choosing, which I think is probably the reasonable thing to do for, you know, when you're resource limited and, you know, in terms of people, especially and time and money and everything, you don't have the tools to implement it fully. But, just like for example, I read, Getting Things Done, right? That's the methodology for like organizing your whole life. And like, I'm not going to run my whole life by the Getting Things Done rules. Like I would go insane, but there are lots of little tricks in there that I picked up and I use, and some of them I didn't use, but, yeah, it's okay to pick and choose that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I'll put this page in the show notes too, but there's just a simple rules page. So reading through the Wikipedia is a little bit dense because it's all just there. But the Extreme Programming site, extremeprogramming.org, just has some simple rules, and they're organized into different categories. So planning, managing, designing, coding, and testing. And there's a lot of stuff that I like in here. For example, under planning, it's user stories, right? So that's one thing that we have been doing is we create a Google Doc, and when we're working on a feature, we try to think about how a user would use this thing. What does it look like? This type of person wants to do this thing so that they can achieve whatever, right? A user story. And so basically it says you start with user stories, and then once you have some user stories, you start thinking about how is this thing going to be released? You start planning a schedule. How long is it going to take? How is it going to be integrated? Is it behind a feature flag? Who has access to this thing? Just release planning. And then basically it advocates dividing that project into small chunks and releasing them as you go. So it talks about making frequent and small releases, which we try to do at Design Collective already. The project is divided into iterations, which also we do. lots of small iterations. So we'll release something as version 1.0, and then we'll come back to it version 1.1, or, you know, add things slowly to it. What I thought was interesting was under managing, it talks about set a sustainable pace. And part of that, it talks about, you know, if it's so funny to me, like you said, all or nothing. Some of these rules are interesting. But one of the rules I read was if developers should not work more than 40 hours a week. And if overtime is required 1 week, you should never require a second week in a row ever. And I like that a lot because that's something that I've been trying to do is set like a hard deadline and like a hard stop time, except for emergencies. But I thought that was interesting too. And then the coding side of things, it talks about how code must be written to an agreed standards. Well, prettier config is a standard that just does the thing, right? Linters and such, right? Code the unit test first, so that it starts talking about TDD. All production code is pair programmed. I could take it or leave that. One of the pair integrates code at a time. So it's talking about sort of one person writing the code, so one person's looking directly what's in front of them, and one person's looking at the big picture, which I kind of like that idea. I've never tried that myself, but I think it seems interesting. Talks about integrate often, which just means commit early and commit often, which I try to do already. Yeah, I don't know. It's cool because it kind of, a lot of the stuff we've all been told is good, like TDD, commit early, commit often, you know, separate project into smaller iterations. It just kind of like put it under an umbrella for me, which I thought was cool.
So, two questions for you. Are there any new things you picked up here that you are not doing and would like to start doing in particular? Because you talked about all the stuff that you like already are doing, and that, you know, makes sense. You just basically just giving it a name, right? But what about just kind of new things that you learned about?
Yeah. So some of the new stuff would be maybe around process. So I think and this isn't to toot my own horn, but we're doing most of this stuff. But I think by giving a name, like something like a bunch of processes a name, I think it almost makes it easier to observe those things. Because as I'm going throughout the day, I'm thinking, okay, TDD, commit early, commit out. I'm thinking like all bunch of different things that in my mind at this point aren't related really. And it's interesting for whatever reason. I don't know if it's like a psychological thing for me, but if I'm able to put one term over a bunch of broader rules, I can think, okay, today I'm extremely programming extremely or whatever. I don't know how you would say that. And for whatever reason, that helps me keep more rules in mind at once. Instead of having to remember A, B, C, D, if I can remember this umbrella, there's like a newly paved road to these other things that I'm trying to remember at any given time. I don't know if that happens to other people, but for me, giving this thing a term helps me recall it easier, quicker. It helps me identify and recall those things faster.
Yeah, I mean, it reduces your cognitive load. Basically, you kind of associate the term with the name, and then that's it. Like, you just make that association. It's one of only, you know, the second hardest thing in programming besides cache invalidation is naming things. So
right, yeah, I guess it's kind of like learning programming design patterns too, right? You can try to remember like good practices, but if you can codify a set of things with a term, it's easier for your brain to recall that. There's like a central location in your memory store. I don't know how to describe it, but yeah, so maybe that's what I was stumbling upon. Was like, oh, I can kind of codify this thing in a term. And again, not that we would want to like subscribe to everything dogmatically, because some of this stuff just wouldn't make sense for Design Collective. Like, there's only two tech people, so that means that we would literally be pair programming all the time, you know, 8 hours a day. That's just not something we can do at this point. But a lot of it makes sense, and being able to codify it, I think, helps. And so, and thinking about transition, you know, obviously I mentioned that Paul is moving on at the end of the month. I'm trying to codify as much as I can for whoever starts, right? So if I can say, oh, we follow most of extreme programming, here's what we try to do, or we follow this or that, I think it would also help that person come on board faster.
You said Paul's moving on at the end of the month, like he's already like dead to you, like he's gone, he's not coming back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that makes a lot of sense. So what, my second question was kind of, what's your plan here? Like, you've been reading about it, you've been kind of documenting some processes that you're already doing, some things you identified, some things you want to do differently. Is your goal to just improve things? Do you, like, are you going to slowly introduce things? You want to just, I don't know. What's your plan? What's your end game with this kind of thing? Because this is, you know, it could go lots of different ways.
Yeah, it could go lots of different ways. I think really my main goal is, like for me, is to be more consistent in these things. I think really that's the main goal. And also what's interesting is that Paul and I have a very similar kind of skill set, right? So we can both work on the API, the back end. We can both do the front end. Paul's also really good at, you know, having a design eye, and being able to kind of like have a taste, like this is confusing, this looks good, this doesn't look good, right? And that's worked out really well. So in the 16 months that Paul's worked with us, we have rewritten the shipping stuff twice, and we've added two handfuls of features. We've added a ton of stuff, right? And what worked out really well was that we were kind of both working on separate projects, and we would, you know, obviously help each other out, talk about things, rubber duck and all that. But pretty much for the last 16 months, we've been both working on two separate projects concurrently. And in looking at the feature set we have, there's not like a ton of outstanding features that people are asking for. There's a couple of things, but there's not like a handful of things. And so in starting to think about what I want Paul's replacement to look like, I started thinking about, okay, what are we going to need in like the next season of Design Collective? And since we don't have a handful of outstanding features, maybe it makes sense to find someone with some real design chops and find someone that is like more UX, more front end focused, because now we have two handfuls of features, but they have both been made by primarily back end focused developers. And not to say that like Paul didn't do a good job, because he did a really good job and he helped us out a lot, but the focus was different, right? And so I started thinking about, okay, maybe it might make sense to let me kind of like really take control of the API and the backend side of things and find someone that's more focused on the front end side of things and has design chops. And a big plus, obviously, would if they were familiar with backend concepts and things like that, you know? And so it just so happens that I actually had a couple of friends that sort of fit that bill, so I've been talking to them. But I think really what that means is like trying to codify some of this stuff is it might help. My main goal is like to help us kind of bridge that gap. So if I'm looking for someone that has primarily a different set of skills than I do, then there's like this gap that needs to be bridged, and we need to be able to work together and communicate effectively. So I think really like what I've been looking for is, how do I do that? Because I've worked on teams of developers before, but again, the teams I've worked on, we've all been working on different projects concurrently. I've never really worked on one project for an extended period of time with someone that has a different skill set than me.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So maybe to see if I can summarize that. So really what you're doing is just sort of, you have the kind of you're moving into more of a CTO role, right? You're kind of adding some structure to it. You're making the path easier forward for the company and for new people, and yeah, trying to codify things. And like you said, you spend your whole day in Google Docs. Like you're not even a developer anymore. You're just a writer.
Yeah, the thinker. Yeah, but yeah, I guess that's what it is. I'm trying to figure out where I would like things to go. And I, you know, obviously these things are all idealistic things, and at the end of the day, the work has to get done, right? And so that's why I'm not as consistent as I want to be, because you just get busy. But I think it's going to be interesting, like having someone with a different skill set and different focus. And so there's a lot of things. I have so many things in my list for refactoring and updating, and I'm going to be able to spend time on that stuff, because another person's, so like when Paul and I are kind of running concurrent things, our focuses are kind of similar, right? So we're both thinking about the front end a little bit because we have to implement the front end for a feature, but we're also both focusing on the back end a lot. And so like in switching those roles up, there's someone, a part of the team, that's like focusing on the front end full time, 100% of the time, instead of 50% of the time. That's going to be new for us. And so it's new for me, you know, it's new for me managing that too. And so, yeah, I mean, apart from like methodologies and processes, I've been thinking about how can I set this person up to be successful with the APIs I give them. We've been working on a GraphQL API for a while. It's not fully implemented, but I'm slowly adding more types and fields to it. And so, yeah, so I'm just kind of doing some planning around that. Like, how can I make this person as successful as they can? Obviously, them having some sort of backend experience or just familiarity with it helps me, like rubber ducking and thinking out loud, I suppose. But, you know, I'm trying to think like, how can I really set them up to succeed and do the best work they can? So yeah, that's what I've been doing. Not so much programming.
Do you see Design Collective adding more developers in the future? Is that something you're thinking about now, or is it just not something that's going to happen soon? I don't know. Like, do you think like you could progress quicker if you had a third or fourth person? You know, how would that change things?
So yeah, that's a good question. And that's something I've actually been talking with my boss about recently. So the surface area that we have, if you go to designcollective.com/features/boutiques, if you go to that page and scroll down, you will see a very hefty table of features and all of that. And there's more like on top of that. That's just stuff that customers would like know affects them. And so there's all these services that exist to support all of those features. And we only have two people. And so this is a discussion I've been having a lot with my boss, is like, hey, the service area is very big for two people, and I can't keep adding stuff and things like quality be there, right? And on top of that, it's also a disservice to all the other features that we already have if we keep adding, because then they don't get any attention. They don't get any better. They stay at a 1.0 status, which isn't fair to customers either. And so that's a conversation we've been having, is like, how much surface area can two people handle? I think we've already surpassed that. Luckily, because of Elixir and Phoenix and how easy it is to kind of refactor and maintain, it's been doable, I think. And like Paul and I aren't really necessarily like sitting here pulling our hair out, but there's a lot of stuff to know about. And so at some point, I think like there's some things that we've talked about we want to add, where I just flat out said, okay, well, if you want to add that, we need another person. Because I can't realistically take on the extra service area and keep doing what I'm doing and do it well. I just can't do that. So maybe one big thing I've learned recently is how to say that, because that's not something I've been saying before previously. Obviously, if you look at the features page, you'll see that. But yeah, it's not something that I've ever said before. So I think you know, when we actually need to add those features, we will be in a position to be adding another person to the stack. Whether that means they are a specialist in that area, I don't know. Whether that means that I train them on how to maintain what we have and then I move on to the new area, I'm not sure either. Honestly, don't know. But it's something we've talked about for sure, and it's something that we're going to be doing. We don't want a big team. I think ideally my team would maybe be four people, five people at the most, ideally. But for now, we have two.
It was a really funny conversation, not really conversation, but experience I had when I started my my job at Agilent years ago. And like I was on a team of maybe a dozen people like working on one layer of the software for this these big, you know, expensive spectrum analyzer hardware boxes. And yeah, my boss said, okay, we have this feature called external mixing, and it's just all this other hardware, USB hardware that plugs into the box. And he says, okay, you own external mixing now. Like, you're the guy. You got to learn it. You got to do all the issues. You got to support it. And so, like, I had to do it. I mean, he told me to, obviously, but, like, no one else could. I was the only person working on this one integration thing. And, like, I did nothing for it for a year. And then all of a sudden, I had a Flurry work on it. And I had to actually figure it out. And obviously, in a team like that, it's a different thing where you can divvy up the products like that and, like, be the go-to guy for feature X. You don't really have that luxury with your kind of team size, obviously, like you said. And yeah, I'm looking at this table. This is daunting. I'm not even reading it. I'm just scrolling up and down and my eyes are glazing over.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of stuff. It is a lot of stuff. And it's a lot to keep reminding people, hey, we have a lot of stuff. And so, what was 2 years ago easy, when it was easy to add stuff willy nilly, it's not anymore. And not that I'm saying we have a buggy app and like adding stuff makes other things fall over, because it's not the case. It's just the keeping everything. And that's another thing I've been thinking about, and we don't have to get into this right now, but documentation beyond, like, you know, we write a lot of docs in Elixir, and thankfully that's because Elixir encourages that. So it just became a habit. So we do document in Elixir a lot. But then there's also a lot of complexity on the front end, you know? And so we have docs, we use Nuxt, and so we use Vue single file components. And we have a docs tag in there that just has Markdown in it. And so we have docs in there. But all we have to, like, tie all the ideas together are just some loose pages of, like, Google Docs hanging around, which isn't great. It's better than nothing. But this was another thing I was thinking about earlier today is kind of just, like, domain-driven design and the idea of boundaries and context, right? And half of domain-driven design is a shared terminology and a shared documentation around your domain, right? It's not necessarily all about the actual code structuring into context and domains. It's about having a shared terminology, something that your sales team understands and something that you understand, right? And then, you know, having documentation around those boundaries as well. So I've been thinking, like, do I push everyone onto Notion? Maybe that's not the right idea. Do I just keep doing it in Google Docs? I don't know. Do I just make a folder of Markdown files? I don't know. But I think the idea is that I want to be documenting these different boundaries, these different contexts that we have. And then I struggle with the idea of, well, I've heard it's bad to document too much too early. Like, you document yourself into a corner, and then, you know, I've heard people say that. So I don't know. There's a lot of stuff rolling around in my head.
There was a discussion on Accidental Tech Podcast this week about they have people writing questions, and someone asked, like, just a general question about commenting, and you know, do you comment your code? Is commenting your code a code smell? And like, your code should be self-documenting. Did you know? And I was just rolling my eyes at, like, people who think that it's, you know,
yeah,
almost never the case generally, but. I don't know what point I was trying to make.
Well, so what's your gut feeling on that? Like, I don't want to push a tool on people. What I want is just, I just want that information somewhere. That's really all I want. And so, like, when a new person comes in, I can say, here's our domain document. Here are the main domains that we cover. Here are the terminologies that affect those domains. And here's the overarching goal. And maybe that's not even, like, intricately, like, here are the tables that are connected, you know, like, here are the foreign keys and stuff, right? That's too in-depth, I think. But more, like, abstract concepts of the business, I think, is what I'm looking at putting together.
I think those are valuable because you don't have to change them often to keep up with the code base. You know what I mean? Like, documenting individual lines of code, like, there's levels of granularity, right? So you document, like, an individual line of code with a comment. You might document a function, that's a higher level. Document a module or a class or a file, right? And then you work your way up. But documenting, like, your whole application, which is basically a bunch of systems all plugged together, I think that makes sense. And at least for someone who's diving in head first, like, that's where you start. Like, no, you know, that's just, like you said, the shared terminology is extremely important. Understanding what things are, what they represent, what they're called, especially if you're new to the industry. Like, half the terms you've mentioned to me, I'd never heard of before in terms of, you know, furniture-related things. And
sure.
And I think that's just true in general. Like, you're not going to hire a furniture expert, right? You're hiring a developer. And yeah, I think that's good. And I think even just like, you know who makes really good marketing businessy diagrams? Freaking Microsoft. If you look at any diagram they make of like the .NET framework, and it's just like a bunch of rectangles kind of organized in some pseudo way that kind of suggests a hierarchy or level of dependency. Like, those are great because you look at them and you're like, this doesn't make any sense. And then you read the thing and you go back and you're like, oh, of course, that's what they were going for. I'll see if I can find an example with the show notes, but even just having a stupid like colored box with gradients with all the different things stacked on top of each other and show how it all fits together. I think that's I know Google Docs has a little draw tool you can get in there and play around.
Yeah, they do. I've used it for sure. Yeah, so these are all the things that are swimming around in my head, I guess. This is what I'm thinking about and not writing code, thankfully. I mean, it's cool that I don't have to be writing code every single day for the business to continue, right? I think that's something that I incorrectly thought for a long time for whatever reason. And so now I'm trying to think, like, how do I set this up for the long haul? You know, how do I set this up for success? How do I get habits going that are good and productive and all that? And, you know, I'm really, really thankful that Phoenix kind of pivoted and pushed me into the domain-driven design, you know, with their context idea, because that really changed how I think about software, how I think about structure. And you've seen my code base because, you know, you've worked on it a couple of times as a freelancer, and you've seen the mistakes I've made along the way. And it's interesting because you can kind of like go through time as you're going through the code base. But where I'm at now, like, I'm thinking, okay, since it's organized into contexts, you can almost write. So if you're looking at like the Ecto documentation, for example, it's like a stinking book. Like, the top level modules have so much documentation in them. And then they build out a site with Xdoc, and that's almost all you need, because your stuff is separated into contexts. Your entry point, main namespace, whatever, can have all the context for you there. I'm using the word context a lot, but can have all the documentation there, and then you can use Xdoc to spit it out, and then you have a plain text searchable website that's generated from your code. To me, that's best case scenario. So I have kind of like the businessy stuff somewhere, and then I have the contextual stuff, the domain stuff that's just generated from the Elixir code base. That doesn't necessarily cover Vue. And I've seen people actually have custom view loaders that take doc elements out of the view components and make a markdown site out of them, which could be cool. But maybe that's what I should strive for, is like having that stuff live in the code base itself. And that means that it's easier to update. It's kind of living with things, and then using tools like Xdoc to build a site that's updated every now and then. But now I'm just rambling now.
No, there's no reason that that those higher level documents also can't live in your Xdoc thing. You know, you can just put random markdown files in your Xdoc, and just, you can throw them in your mix config file. You can tell it, hey, also include these extra files in the sidebar, and then you can just put arbitrary files in there. So you could definitely just do that.
Right. Yeah. I should probably put together some stuff like this. It's just something that we need, you know? I mean, even though we're two people, there's always times where Paul and I are like, do you remember how this thing works? No, I don't remember it. Do you remember it? No. Okay. Well, let's hop on a screen share and like dig down through the code and try to figure it out. And so we usually end up adding documentation that way, but yeah.
There's also a flip side to this, and that's like, you don't want the documentation to get in the way. Like, I have a library that I've worked on. I haven't released it yet, but it's tangentially related to what we're doing with Robot Ham Radio. Anyway, it's Elixir library, and like, I can't really blame it on, this is a bad thing to blame it on, like, I'm just looking for excuses, but the thing I got hung up on was like the level of documentation for Elixir libraries and the whole community is so high. And my library is not that complex. It's a little complex. It has lots of stuff in it. And like, I documented as much as I could, but I just kind of got burned out documenting, especially like tutorials and getting started and stuff. It's like, I wanted to have all the stuff in place so that when people started looking at it, they could kind of follow along and get an idea. But like, but I didn't complete it, and I didn't want to release it without that, you know, like I said, just that level of quality. And so it's just kind of sitting there. Just, it's like all 98% there to like a 0.1 release, right? And it's I don't know. You don't want to slow down your growth either, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. 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 That's another good point. Well, we'll see what happens. Time will tell, because you can't stop time, right?
Keeps on ticking.
Keeps on ticking. Well, I guess on that note, if I'm sure people have hot takes about what we just talked about. I am positive that people have hot takes, because I read them on the internet, and I would love to hear all of the hot takes. If you know, people have experience working places that have too many processes, too little processes, just enough processes. It's like Goldilocks, right? Would love to hear about any of that stuff.
You can tell us all about those things on Twitter at DNC Show, or you can message Sean directly at Sean Washbot. You can find me over there, Shrockwell, on the Twitterverse.
My DMs are open. My DMs are open.
You slide right in there.
Ready for hot takes. The show notes, as always, are going to be at dnc.show. I made sure to put all the links that we talked about in there, and also the various diagrams that Rockwell is talking about. So if you'd like to look at those and see what we're talking about, head on over to dnc.show, and the newest episode will be in the top left corner of the episode list. So you should check out the show notes there.
We'll also post show notes over in spectrum.chat, or you can check them out and have a discussion with us about them. We're hanging out over there. Come say hi, or come say that you hate us. Either way, it's feedback. It's all good.
Yeah, any feedback is just, we're happy. Just let us know what you're thinking, positive or negative. Also, on the note of new beginnings and endings, if you're looking for a new job, you should head over to spec.fm/jobs and check out what they've got over there. I know for a fact there are at least 4 or 5 open listings there, so head on over to spec.fm/jobs and check out some of the greener pastures that are around. And as always, thanks to spec.fm for having us, putting up with us, putting up with my sick voice. And shout out to Mikhail for covering for me. Was it last week or the week before? I don't know if I thanked him officially, but thanks, Mikhail, for covering for me when I was gone. If you're interested in other design and development related podcasts, you should head over to spec.fm and check out the shows over there.
This week's episode of Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport and produced by Sarah Jackson. Dude, I'm going to mail you some cough drops or something. Drop ship them to your house via Amazon drone.
I was doing good. I was doing good until the end.
Talk to you later.
Talk to you later.
Thanks again to Sentry.io for sponsoring Does Not Compute. Don't wait for your users to report errors to fix them. Iterate on your application faster, improve your users' happiness, and make a better product with Sentry's comprehensive error reporting platform. Give them a try at Sentry.io.